Hello, and welcome to this podcast focusing on health equity and patient-centered care in triple-negative breast cancer. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent online activity, Drs. Catherine Post and Aditya Bardia will discuss the drivers of disparities in triple-negative breast cancer outcomes, patient-centered strategies for closing gaps in access to testing and treatment, and real-world cases showing how these barriers shape clinical decisions. This activity is provided by PER and supported by an educational grant from Gilead Sciences, Inc. In the first segment, Dr. Post maps the drivers of disparities in triple-negative breast cancer outcomes.
I'll be talking about mapping disparities in triple-negative breast cancer outcomes. In our learning objective, at the end of the talk, hopefully you'll be able to recognize key drivers and disparities of triple-negative breast cancer treatment outcomes. And we know that there are significant disparities that exist in triple-negative breast cancer outcomes driven by the intersection of racial and ethnic differences, socioeconomic factors, access to care, and tumor biology. The most pronounced disparity is between Black and white women, with Black women experiencing both higher triple-negative breast cancer incidence and worse survival. This difference in breast cancer mortality persists even after adjusting for demographic, clinical, treatment, and neighborhood factors and analyses. Black women still have a 17% higher breast cancer mortality. The differences are likely driven by later breast cancer stage of diagnosis, treatment delays, and lower treatment completion rates, as well as differences in tumor biology. Patients from minority backgrounds are more likely to present with stage 3 to 4 breast cancer, and later stage directly correlates with lower survival and fewer treatment options. Cancer screening rates tend to be lower when patients must travel long distances to access it, and time to treatment delays of more than 30 days are associated with decreased survival. This includes delays to biopsy, pathology, referral to oncology care, and delays to surgery after neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And research has demonstrated that Black patients with metastatic breast cancer experience 7.8 additional days to immunotherapy as compared to white patients. There are also socioeconomic disparities contributing to worse outcomes for some patient populations. For example, triple-negative breast cancer mortality is linked to areas with fewer NCI-designated cancer centers and states with Medicaid expansion gaps, whereas those states with Medicaid expansion show improved early-stage triple-negative breast cancer diagnosis rates and survival. Patients must also navigate a complex and fragmented authorization process, leading to time-to-treatment delays and higher costs. And social factors must be considered, as patients may need resources and support in order to adhere to treatment. So a related factor is time toxicity, which can be defined as the time spent in coordinating care and in frequent visits to a healthcare facility, seeing urgent, emergent care for side effects, hospitalization, and follow-up tests. Time is a resource, and we don't often think of it that way, but we should. And time toxicity is likely more toxic for patients with less flexible workplaces, those who need assistance or resources for childcare or elder care, and those who have limited resources for travel and parking. Another area of triple-negative breast cancer care that reinforces the disparities that exist in triple-negative breast cancer is access to biomarker testing. Despite the fact that the NCCN recommends a biomarker-driven approach to treatment selection for patients with triple-negative breast cancer, community oncology sites show lower PD-L1 testing completion rates versus academic centers, and only about 35% of patients with advanced cancers are currently receiving molecular testing. And this number is even lower in patients from minority backgrounds. We also know that germline BRCA testing is underutilized in Black women, despite the higher prevalence of BRCA1 mutations in Black women. We also know that authorization delays in underinsured patients increase time to treatment and, again, leading to higher costs. Further, the clinical trial enrollment gaps for patients of racial or ethnic minority backgrounds is clear. Despite the fact that Black and Hispanic or Latino patients make up about 20% of the triple-negative breast cancer patient population, they only account for 5 to 10% of clinical trial participants. The stakes for ensuring that all patients with triple-negative breast cancer receive guideline-concordant care are high. New therapies are improving outcomes, but only for those who can access them. Lastly, I want to close this very brief talk by providing some actionable recommendations and takeaways. We can improve breast cancer screening rates with things like mobile mammography units, community partnerships, and patient navigation programs. We should implement universal reflex biomarker testing for all patients with triple-negative breast cancer at diagnosis. We need to expand clinical trial access to all patients, broadening eligibility criteria, partnering with community sites, and providing inclusive trial materials. We need to address social determinants and work within our institutions and more broadly to develop resources and support for patients who need them. We need to diversify the clinical workforce to improve trust and cultural competence of care. And lastly, we need to advocate for policy change to help make all of this possible.
In the next segment, Dr. Bardia examines gaps in access to biomarker testing and novel therapies and the barriers patients face in reaching treatment.
Let's talk about management of metastatic TNBC. There are two biomarkers that one needs to consider. The first one is PD-L1 because that's actionable, and the second one is germline BRCA because that's actionable as well. For patients with metastatic TNBC who have PD-L1 positive disease, one would recommend antibody drug conjugate or chemotherapy plus pembrolizumab. And for patients who have PD-L1 negative metastatic TNBC, it's ADC or chemotherapy. We now have two ADCs that are approved, Dato-DXd as well as sacituzumab govitecan, as first-line therapy for patients with metastatic TNBC. In germline BRCA, we have PARP inhibitors. But what we're seeing is in real-world setting, a number of patients don't have timely access to PD-L1 testing, don't have access to germline BRCA testing, and that's a missed opportunity. You know, there are various barriers. It could be that patient does not have sufficient tissue for PD-L1 testing. It could be that the specimen was sent, but the analysis could not be performed. But I would remind the audience that any specimen can be sent for PD-L1 testing, and if metastatic is not sufficient, you could certainly send the primary tumor. And for germline BRCA testing, that could be a blood test, it could be a cheek swab. So just working with the team and ensuring that these tests are sent becomes very important because that's actionable. There could also be additional barriers in terms of financial barriers, in terms of geographic barriers, and these are important to address as well. In terms of financial barriers, often the sponsors or drug companies will provide access to the drug, and sometimes they have patient assistance programs as well that can even help with biomarker testing. So the key is to talk to your provider and ensure that you get access to the latest therapies that potentially could change outcomes for metastatic disease. And this is important because these gaps otherwise could change the outcome or survival. You know, we've seen from these studies, be it ASCENT-03 or 04, TROPION-Breast02, or the PARP inhibitor studies, that there can be improvement in terms of progression-free survival. And some of these studies have also shown improvement in overall survival. And for immunotherapy, we know that, you know, it can improve overall survival. And for a subset of patients, it can result in prolonged disease control. So these are important drugs, and it's important that patient gets the testing so they can receive access to these drugs. In terms of equity, this is an issue that has been seen. Enrollment in clinical trials, as well as diagnostics testing, as well as access to these latest therapies, there is equity based on region, based on race, ethnicity, and these are barriers that need to be addressed so that all patients can derive benefit from these drugs. Let's talk about different barriers to care, financial, cultural, logistical barriers to care. I'll start with financial. If you talk about newer drugs, antibody drug conjugates, PARP inhibitors, immunotherapy, these are expensive drugs. And if a patient does not have insurance or there's a high out-of-pocket cost, these can be practical barriers for patients in terms of accessing these drugs. There are potential solutions. Number of centers have programs, patient assistance programs, financial counseling that could help. There are foundations, that potentially could help. American Cancer Society, or ACS, has the Hope Lodge that can provide for lodging, especially for patients going on clinical trials if they need to be near an academic center. And finally, sponsors, they have patient assistance programs. So if there's a patient who's a good candidate for this therapy but cannot afford the therapy for financial reasons, it's very important to explore these options so that patient can derive benefit from these drugs. The second component I want to address is the cultural component, and this is much more complex. And this goes in terms of, you know, access to drugs, access to clinical trials, compliance with drugs, management of adverse events. And there's no easy solution or one solution to address the cultural barrier, but there are potential steps one could take. The first being being in a culturally sensitive setting, have a culturally sensitive communication, have a diverse team, so you have people from different cultures represented, and then also having certain cultural education programs. So that, you know, we all have biases, but if we can minimize those biases by appropriate education and counseling, that's helpful for everyone. And then the final piece I want to touch on is the geographic or logistical barriers. There have been multiple studies which have shown that because of these barriers, not only is access to therapy compromised, but access to biomarker testing, access to genotyping, and this can indirectly translate into worse outcomes. There are various strategies. The first is obviously trying to find a center closest to the patient, ensuring that it's not only the downtown center that has the clinical trial, but all the community sites also have access to important studies, so it's less travel for the patient. And then also making use of virtual visits, remote monitoring, that can really minimize the time it takes to reach to a center or time a patient has to take off work or from other duties that are important to them. So if we apply these factors, we won't be able to eliminate disparities, but we can certainly reduce the various barriers that can prevent access to biomarker testing as well as therapies. And this really becomes important for newer drugs like antibody drug conjugates. It's important that we use these drugs in the appropriate setting. These drugs can also have side effects. Sacituzumab govitecan can cause diarrhea, neutropenia, Dato-DXT can cause mucositis. So it's important that patients are treated with empathy, with clarity. There's a clear plan in terms of how to manage these side effects. I usually have a follow-up visit after I start any of these drugs, day 7, day 8, have a follow-up visit. It could be virtual, just to check in how the patient is doing. Often the side effects are seen in the first two cycles, and that's something that's new for the patient. And if you manage those side effects well, it's much easier later on. So the first couple of months requires a lot of hand-holding, counseling, empathy, and that can help ensure that patient, not only survival is improved, but the quality of life is also maintained. And then finally, with any of this, when we start drug as well as during the journey, it is shared decision making between the patient and the provider and different team members. So if you involve the different members in the shared decision making, it just helps ensure that patient can remain on the drug, is compliant, and can derive maximum benefit with the drug while maintaining their quality of life.
In the final segment, Drs. Bardia and Post work through a series of cases that show how these gaps play out in practice.
Great. So let's start with the first case. We have a 57-year-old Black woman presenting with de novo metastatic triple-negative breast cancer, PD-L1 status unknown. She started chemotherapy 2 weeks ago at a local community clinic without documented biomarker testing. She has a strong family history of breast and ovarian cancer, and the patient is on Medicaid.
Yeah, thanks, Dr. Post. Thanks for reviewing this case. Looks like this patient had metastatic TNBC but didn't have any biomarker testing. So how would you approach retrospective biomarker testing for this patient?
So I think the first thing is to determine whether or not we have confirmed receptors with a biopsy of a metastatic site, as up to 40% of patients may not have this done at the time of presentation. And it would also be really important for this particular patient, given her strong family history of breast cancer, to undergo germline testing for BRCA1 and 2, and we may also want to consider PALB2. And of course, PD-L1 testing would be critical. And as it was not performed prior to her initial treatment, it can be still run to help us with second line treatment options or whether or not we want to add any agent to her current treatment. And then we also want to consider multi-gene panel testing, which NCCN recommends for when this patient, if and when they do recur, we can identify candidates for targeted therapies.
No, that's a great point. All these tests are important because they are actionable. And now in June 2026, we also have sacituzumab govitecan plus pembro approved for PD-L1 positive metastatic TNBC, SG alone for PD-L1 negative metastatic TNBC, PARP inhibitors. So these are actionable. And so, Dr. Post, what barriers could have less to this mistesting, and how can they be addressed?
I think first, we should consider where the geographic location of the patient is. Are they at a community clinic where there may be limited testing availability? There could even be clinician-level knowledge gaps that may have prevented this from getting done. Minoritized patients we know have lower biomarker testing completion rates, so this is really something to think about. The patient may also have faced barriers due to underinsurance or being uninsured. So even if they were referred, navigating the complex prior authorization process, and sometimes with underinsured patients, they're facing really high costs to get biomarker testing done. So all of this could have contributed to why this patient was not tested at diagnosis.
Missed opportunity and a great points in terms of factors and barriers because those need to be addressed. And for this patient, the patient could be a candidate for one of these targeted therapies, ADC, IO, but that was missed because of biomarker testing. So great educational points and thanks for sharing that, Dr. Post.
Yes.
We'll move on to case two.
Great. So for case two, a 44-year-old Latina patient with residual disease after neoadjuvant chemotherapy for stage two triple negative breast cancer. This patient is BRCA wild type. Her PD-L1 status is a CPS of 8, and her oncologist is unsure whether to refer for ongoing adjuvant therapy or clinical trial participation. The patient lives 2 hours from the nearest academic center and speaks primarily Spanish.
Yeah, important case. This patient has residual disease despite neoadjuvant therapy, and there are a number of adjuvant trials with novel drugs with antibody drug conjugates, sacituzumab govitecan, sacituzumab tirumotecan, other ADC and novel therapy trials, and those could be great option for this patient, but we are seeing some practical barriers. So, Dr. Post, would you mind commenting on, potential barriers for this patient, geographic, language, and potential solutions so that this patient could be considered for a clinical trial and participate in an important study?
Absolutely. Great question. So, as you alluded to, this patient could very well have been eligible for an antibody drug conjugate trial, depending on trial eligibility, of course, but thinking of things like ASCENT-05 or TROPION-03. But this really should be discussed at diagnosis with the initial treatment planning. And again, some solutions for how we can do this better, especially in patients who may not be English speaking. We want to consider translating at least study consent forms, if not all patient materials, patient-facing materials, into various languages so that we can broaden our reach of patients that might not be English speaking. We can also work with our colleagues. There are excellent translators, patient navigator programs, clinical trial navigator programs that can help patients better navigate this complex system. And we also want to think about providing financial resources for things like travel. This patient specifically lives far from the academic center. So what resources are available or can we provide for things like travel, childcare, and copay assistance as well? We also always want to be mindful about hiring research staff that reflect the patient population. So having a diverse research staff, again, making study materials available in multiple languages. And also, I think it's really important for clinicians to be really transparent upfront with patients about cost and time commitment so that patients can make a decision that's best for them.
Great points. It's these multiple factors which potentially can help. So to build on this further, how can the research team, providers help with shared decision making? Some of these trials can be complex with different arms, newer therapies. So how can the team help the patient in terms of shared decision making?
That's a great point. So I think having biomarker testing done upfront and testing for, the multi-gene panel is important because not just for first-line decisions, but as these patients progress, it would be great to know the mutation status so that you and the patient can be working together to think about and plan next steps. The best clinicians I work with and oncologists will have several different next steps available for their patients based on actionable mutations. And these are conversations that can start well before you actually need to consent and get into trial, because I think the informed consent process really is a process and should not be a one-time event. So, making sure that the oncologist has enough time to discuss informed consent, that patients aren't feeling rushed, and again, being really transparent upfront about what being involved in that particular clinical trial involves.
That's a great point. And that would certainly help because it's tough to give all the information at once. But if you plan ahead and say, if this doesn't work out, there's a plan B and these are potential options, I think that certainly helps. And you brought up a great point about this patient, which is that the discussion of adjuvant therapy should start with neoadjuvant therapy. When a patient is getting neoadjuvant therapy, just letting them know if we see residual disease, there might be an option available for you. So just planting that seed early certainly can help. So thanks for sharing that, Dr. Post.
Absolutely.
Okay, case three.
Great. So for case D, we have a 62-year-old woman with PD-L1 positive metastatic triple-negative breast cancer who delays starting pembrolizumab plus chemotherapy due to high out-of-pocket costs. They present later with disease progression, and the oncologist considers second-line sacituzumab govitecan based on ASCENT, but coverage is uncertain.
Your cost can be a big barrier and a very practical one as well. So, how can providers proactively address cost barriers that otherwise delays treatment?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, again, I'm going to go back to planning ahead. I think leaders in clinical trial programs really need to be advocates for financial resources and support for their patients. So that way, this is a viable option for all patients. We can lean on our colleagues in patient navigation if you have that available. In social work, they can be really good at helping patients seek out resources that they may need above and beyond what your program can provide. Our financial counseling team is also fantastic to help us and help patients navigate that complex prior authorization process and hopefully reduce delays like what happened with this patient. And I think we all need to advocate for policy change to ensure or encourage insurers to cover novel therapies with evidence supporting improved outcomes. And copay assistance programs are also really helpful, nonprofit disease-specific funds. And again, logistic and travel assistance are critical for patients to be able to participate.
Let's build on this further. So you mentioned financial resources and support. Are there other resources or programs that can help patients, particularly access to novel ADCs?
Absolutely. So a lot of companies will provide things like copay assistance cards. And there are also foundations like the American Cancer Society I can think of. They have the Hope Lodge here in Boston where patients can stay while they're receiving treatment if they live a long distance away. So again, that travel assistance and making it feasible for patients, those are two great examples. And we really do lean on our colleagues in social work to help us help patients seek out, nonprofits and other disease-specific funds that may help patients participate in clinical trials.
That's great. And then finally, what about off-label or compassionate use? When is that reasonable to consider and feasible in the real-world setting?
Yeah, I think compassionate use is a really important aspect of treatment for some patients, and this would be appropriate when a patient has a serious or life-threatening condition like an advanced cancer, and they might have exhausted all approved treatment options, and they can't enroll in a clinical trial for some reason. You know, thinking about patients with like autoimmune disorders that may not be able to receive immunotherapy, and there is an available drug that might be still investigational, but there is a plausible therapeutic rationale where this patient could potentially benefit, and that would justify any potential risks. So I think that's an example of where compassionate use would really be a viable option.
You know, that's a great point. Clinical trial eligibility can be restrictive, and a patient needs access to the drug who's otherwise not eligible. This is a great path. So thanks for highlighting that.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description.